Welcome to The Craft of Preaching, an online conference hosted by Luther Seminary, October 5th through 7th, 2020. This episode features a sermon on 1 Peter 3, 8-22 by Jared Alcantara, entitled, How to Remain Hopeful in a Pandemic.
When was the last time that you were on a plane? Think about it for a moment. Some of you don't fly very much, so maybe it's been a long time since you've been on a plane. Some of you fly more often, but it's been a little while since you were last on a plane. Some of you, the last time you were on a plane was life before COVID. I'm a homiletics professor, and I preach at churches on the weekends, and so in the past, I was on planes all the time. I was going to different places to preach or to present academic papers or to attend conferences. My wife's side of the family's on the West Coast, and my side of the family's on the East Coast, and we live neither of those places, and so we have to fly in order to see them. You know, one of the last times that I was on a plane, it's not too long ago, it was in January in the pre-COVID era of this world. I was headed to Honduras to see my father's side of the family. My father's from La Ceiba, Honduras. He's one of eight children. My dad's name is Jose. He's a triplet, actually, and his brother's name is Jesus, and his sister's name, she's deceased now, but her name was Maria, so you have the Holy Family right there, right? Joseph, Mary, and Jesus, La Sagrada Familia right there. I went to Honduras in January to visit my tia, that means aunt in Spanish. My tia Gloria was celebrating her 90th birthday, and it was a great excuse for me to go and to spend time with her and spend time with extended family, a good chance to see a lot of people in a short amount of time. So it was wonderful, but I'll never forget the conversation that I had before I went, and it's a conversation that I have every time with a concerned friend who sits down with me right before I leave. And usually the conversation goes something like this: Jared, I want you to make sure that you stay safe, okay? You know, Honduras has lots of drugs and gang violence, and you know, the government is corrupt. You could get malaria. Make sure you stay safe, okay? And you know, the strangest thing happened. I flew to Honduras, and whenever I have those conversations, I try to be patient. Sometimes I handle it better than others, and there's some truth to it. I mean, there are dangerous places in Honduras. My family, they live in places that are relatively safe, and so I don't normally think much about it. I went to Honduras. I celebrated my tia's 90th birthday. It was a wonderful celebration, and as I'm sitting at the celebration, a cousin comes and sits down next to me, my prima, my female cousin, sits down next to me, and she's a concerned family member. She sits down, and she says, primo, cousin, this male cousin in English, when you go back to the United States, make sure you stay safe, okay? You know, they have lots of drugs and gang violence, and you know, people shoot each other in shopping malls there and in churches, and you know, the government is corrupt, primo. You could get all manner of disease. Just stay safe, okay? Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Little did I know earlier this year, earlier in hashtag 2020 stinks, that by the time all of those months had passed, I'd be hearing that message over and over again. People would sign off their emails saying, make sure you stay safe, okay? People would end their phone calls with the phrase, make sure you stay safe, okay? Now, it's a strange and peculiar time in our world. It's a time of pandemic. Some communities feel like they're going through two pandemics. There's the COVID-19 pandemic, and then there's the ongoing and festering racial wound pandemic that's impacting some communities disproportionately than it's impacting others. Some people feel like the floorboards are shaking beneath their feet. Some people feel very uncertain and anxious about the future. Perhaps COVID-19 has touched your family in a particular way. I know it has mine. But here's the thing. Perhaps we could say it's the divine economy that this is the case. But in so many ways, those questions that we're asking are not new questions at all. Those questions about whether or not we're going to be okay, whether or not we're going to make it through this time, whether or not we're going to get from here to the other side of this, Those aren't questions that are new at all, actually. Christians all over the world ask them all the time. Christians across time and space have asked them as well. It's part of the divine economy, I would say, that these are the questions that are so often asked, not only throughout the world and across time and space. These are the questions that were asked by the community to whom the author of 1 Peter was writing. Are we going to be able to get through this? How are we going to survive this hardship? We don't even know what tomorrow will bring. That's really what the book of 1 Peter is about. It's about enduring hardship and remaining hopeful in the midst of crisis, especially in the face of suffering. That's not only what the book is about, that's what this chapter is about, and that's what these verses are about. It's important to remember that this book was written to persecuted Christians who were trying to remain resilient and faithful and hope-filled when everything around them was calling into question the promises of God. And so, I want to submit to you that there's a way to remain hopeful, even in the midst of a pandemic. Now, what's the answer to that question? How do we remain hopeful in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of a crisis? How do we remain resilient? How do we endure hardship and stay steadfast? Well, I think there's a few clues. Now, we could conclude from those first couple of verses that the secret to remaining hopeful in a pandemic is to love each other better than we do now. Did you notice those commands? Be like-minded, all of you. So the author is addressing wives and husbands and different segments of the church, and now it's everybody. Everybody, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love each other, be compassionate, be humble. Don't repay evil with evil or insult with insult. Do what comes unnaturally, repay evil with blessing. Oh, it would be an amazing thing if Christians loved each other better than they did now, better than they do now. I think we'd make the news for all the right reasons, wouldn't we? I think people who are members of the least or the lonely or the lost, the stranger, the sojourner, the foreigner would be received with open arms. People wouldn't be drawing lines and taking sides. People would be embracing and loving each other, wouldn't they? People would know and be known if the church and members of the church treated one another more like brothers and sisters in Christ. It'd be an amazing thing, wouldn't it be? If followers of Jesus Christ were like-minded, that doesn't mean that you have to agree with each other on everything. It means that you decide that even in your disagreement, that you're going to be on mission with God and with God's people. Love each other, that's that word Philadelphia, to love your neighbor as your brother or sister, to be compassionate, a willingness to suffer with. It's the word that's used in the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's the word that's used of Jesus. Jesus is filled with compassion, the scriptures say. Be humble. It means that you don't have a big head. It means that you listen more than you speak. It means that you don't have to be right all the time. It means that you're willing to say sorry. It means that you put others even before yourself. Not that you think less of yourself, but that you think of yourself less. So maybe that's the secret to remaining hopeful in the midst of a pandemic, that we love each other better than we do now. That's good, that's right, that's necessary. The world would be a better place if we did that, wouldn't it? But then there's this turn in the text. It's not just about us. Maybe the secret to remaining hopeful in the midst of a crisis is that we love those outside the fellowship better than we do now. I want you to notice the turn in verse 13. There's a quotation from Psalm 34, which is really this pointer to the fact that there's a connection between the good life and seeking peace and love and care for one another. But then the turn in the text happens in verse 13. Who's going to harm you if you're eager to do what's good? Who's the who there? I sound like Dr. Seuss. But who's the who there? The who is those who are outside the fellowship of believers. If you're eager to follow Christ, if you're eager to pursue him, you don't need to be afraid of their threats. That's verse 14. You don't need to be frightened. Rather, revere Christ Jesus as Lord in your hearts. Always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that you have to those outside the fellowship. but always do so with gentleness and respect. You know, there's a proverb from India that goes like this: there's no use offering someone a rose but punching them in the nose before you do. What does that mean? Well, if you're going to offer something sweet, why would you insult them first? Always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that you have, of course, but always do it with gentleness and respect. Don't be afraid. Don't be frightened. Keep a clear conscience. And as you do, those who speak maliciously against you will somehow, since God has a way of turning things around, somehow they'll be ashamed of their slander. Somehow God will bring about good to those outside the fellowship. Now, we know what's at stake here if we spend time thinking about it, especially as Christian leaders. We know what's at stake when Christians don't love those outside the fellowship very well. You know what the number one reason is that people give for why they don't want to become Christians? It's Christians. I think of the character Zarathustra in Nietzsche's famous volume, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. The character puts it this way: to believe in their Redeemer, more redeemed his disciples would have to look to me. I think of what Mahatma Gandhi said to that famous Methodist missionary, E. Stanley Jones. You might remember when Gandhi was younger, he was training to be a lawyer in South Africa, and he was mortified by how white Christians treated black South African Christians during the era of apartheid, so mortified that this could happen in a church that claimed to practice brotherly and sisterly love. And so when E. Stanley Jones asked Gandhi how the gospel might make inroads in India, you know what Gandhi said? I would suggest, first of all, that all of you Christians, missionaries and all, begin to live more like Jesus Christ. So we know what's at stake when Christians don't love those outside the fellowship. But here's the thing. You want to know what the number one reason is that people give for why they do become Christians? It's Christians. When believers in Jesus Christ decide to keep a peculiar, eternal perspective on things, when they remain hopeful even in the face of suffering, when they extend love and care and generosity for those who are less fortunate. I'm reminded of a friend of mine who became a social worker after he graduated from college. It was in the early 2000s, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Many refugees had been displaced from war-torn countries in West Africa and Central Africa, most of whom were Muslim. Imagine what it must have been like to be a Muslim shortly after 9/11 in 2001 in America. But my friend wasn't in your face. He just loved people, helped kids get into school, helped people get their driver's license, helped them find a home, find a job. And one time, one of the people who he was working with, after more than a year of building a friendship, asked him. He said, "Scott, why is it that Christians love Muslims so much?" You see, it's an amazing thing when Christians love those outside the fellowship. It's attractive, it's dynamic, it's magnetic. Even if people aren't sure whether or not they believe it, when they look on the lives of those who are Christ followers, they say, "I don't know if I believe it, but that person makes me want to believe it." So maybe that's the secret to remaining hopeful, that we love those outside the fellowship more than we do now. It's good, it's right, it's true, it's necessary, it's life-changing, it could be world-changing even. Well, that's not all there is in this text. There's another turn as well. I invite you to look with me at verse 17. "For it's better, if it's God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil." Remember, persecuted Christians enduring immense hardship. So if you're going to suffer, it's better to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. "For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God." Maybe the secret to remaining hopeful in the midst of a pandemic is to look to the one who went before us, no matter what we're facing. Now, I want to offer an asterisk here, especially as someone who teaches at a seminary, that there are some dangerous ways to treat a text like this. In fact, sometimes texts like this and other passages in 1 Peter chapter 3 or verses in 1 Peter chapter 3 have been used to harm marginalized and oppressed communities. But let me just offer a word about that. Shively Smith, the brilliant black biblical commentator who's written on 1 Peter chapter 3, points this out, that even though the text has been used to harm communities so often, that that's not the original audience. This is what Shively Smith says. 1 Peter is the writing of the slave. It's the writing from the underclass, for the underclass, not for the overlord. So in the midst of hardship, there's some survival strategies that'll help you get from here to there. And one of those strategies may well be to look to the one who went before you and to know that Christ knows your hardship. I'm reminded of what Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote. Now, I'm not referring to his book on ethics or his book on preaching or his book on community. I'm referring to what he wrote in his prison cell shortly before he was killed. It's a real simple statement. Only a suffering God can help. You know, that'll preach. That'll preach to the person who lost a loved one to coronavirus. That'll preach to the single parent whose spouse walked out on the family. That'll preach to the person who's suffering all manner of racial injustice to know that there is one who was not only misunderstood but mistreated. That'll preach to the one who's going through yet another round of chemotherapy. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows but Jesus. Now let me say, I don't know exactly what it means when it says that Christ went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, so I don't claim to be able to solve every exegetical hurdle. Let me quote from Martin Luther here, who says, I don't know what he's talking about. No, that's a paraphrase. Martin Luther wrote these words, a more obscure passage perhaps than any other in the New Testament, so I do not know for a certainty what Peter means here. My favorite was what one commentator said, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, of this we can be certain that Jesus went somewhere to preach to some spirits in some prison. Okay, thank you very much. How much does this commentary cost? So I don't claim to know all the answers. Perhaps that passage means that Jesus went somewhere that we could not go in order to bring us somewhere where we could not go. I don't know. But here's what I do know. Only a suffering God can help. Even so, I'm not sure that really gets at the main thrust of the text. I mean, there's so much here. Of course, we should love each other better. Of course, we should love those outside the fellowship more than we do now. Of course, we should look to the one who goes before us. But I think there's one more turn in the text. There's clues throughout. In verse 9, we're urged to repay evil with blessing, and then there's this phrase, so that you may inherit a blessing. Later on, be prepared to give an answer to everyone for the reason, to give the reason for the hope that you have. Well, what's that hope? We get another clue, especially at the end of verse 18. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit. And I think the most obvious pointer is in verse 21. This water symbolizes baptism that saves you. That word saves there means heals, makes you whole. It saves you. Here it is. By the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. The real secret, I would argue, to remaining hopeful in the midst of a pandemic is this. Vindication will come tomorrow for those enduring hardship today. And so I want to invite you to remember resurrection today. Remember that he who was put to death in the body was made alive in the spirit. Remember that not even death or the grave could keep Jesus from raising again. I don't mean that in any sort of triumphalistic way. What I mean that instead, I mean it to say that whatever we're going through, whatever challenge you're facing as a Christian leader, remember the words of that old gospel song, that trouble don't last always. Leslie Newbegin, before he was a well-known missiologist, was a bishop in the Church of South India. And from time to time, journalists would ask him, how do you feel about the future of the church in India. And his response was simple. I believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, he would say. Here's what Newbegin writes. When people would ask me, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the gospel in India? I would say, I believe the resurrection of Jesus. Therefore, the question does not arise. The gospel is the news of a fact, so you cannot so much be optimistic or pessimistic about it. The real question is, do you believe it or do you not believe it? There's a truth about those who remember resurrection. They believe in one who knows firsthand that trouble don't last always.